From the Sky News Centre at 5, Iran's been told anti-British comments by the country's supreme leader are unacceptable. The deputy ambassador was summoned to the Foreign Office after Ayatollah Ali Khamenei gave a speech saying Britain was treacherous and sinister. His supporters chanted, "Death to the UK." More protests against the disputed presidential election results are expected tomorrow. Gordon Brown says Iran must prove it's serious about democracy.
It is for Iran now to show the world that the elections have been fair. It is also for Iran to show the world that the repression and the brutality that we've seen in these last few days is not something that is going to be repeated.
Amanda Knox has been back in court in Italy to hear her mother give evidence in the Meredith Kircher murder trial. Edda Mellis told the court her daughter, who denies murder, initially accused bar owner Patrick Lumumba of being the killer under the pressure of police questioning. She acknowledged he was later cleared of involvement.
She was pressured to come up with possibilities of somebody, and she felt terrible that Patrick was the one that they kept pointing to.
Seven members of two rival biker gangs have been jailed for 6 years each for rioting at Birmingham Airport. One man was almost killed when Hells Angels and the Outlaws fought after getting off a flight from Spain last year. Sir Alan Stanford will appear in court in the next hour in the US, accused of fraud worth $8 billion. The Texan billionaire, who bankrolled 2020 cricket involving England, denies running a so-called pyramid scheme. The indictment claims he fraudulently sold certificates of deposit with improbably high interest rates from his Stanford International Bank based in Antigua. Baroness Thatcher's had surgery on her broken arm. Doctors inserted a pin to help the bone heal after her fall last week. The former PM's son Mark says the operation went well. And Formula One's governing body is starting legal action against 8 teams who want to form a breakaway championship. The row's over plans to introduce an F1 budget cap. That's the latest. I'm Ursula Hansford.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225. Or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Już wkrótce na falach BCFM, radiowski, audycja w języku polskim. Zaczynamy w niedzielę 17 maja o godzinie 19.
Radiowski, Polish Language Broadcasting, Sunday at 7 PM.
Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week we have two local politicians. Michael Popham is Clifton East councillor from the leading Liberal Democrat group and is cabinet member for Value for Money. And Charlie Bolton is Bristol's only Green councillor and he hails from Southville. Drive Time's Neil Roberts reports this week on the local Iranian population here in Bristol who've been protesting about the electoral crisis in Iran. So we'll be finding out what Bristol's Iranians think about it all later in the show. But before that, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. Temperatures this weekend around 15 degrees Celsius, which is 60 Fahrenheit, and quite cloudy this weekend. Next week, though, is looking up, topping 20 degrees Celsius, that's around 70 Fahrenheit, And Monday will be a little less cloudy than the weekend, but we've got a week of sun starting on Tuesday. That's the 23rd of June to the 30th of June. So Tuesday through to Friday, much sunnier, as is next weekend. That's the 27th and 28th of June. We're talking about a little bit cooler, below 20 degrees Celsius to 65 Fahrenheit. And it will be very sunny and warm. That's not this weekend, but next weekend. Week after next, cooler, going down to 16 Celsius. So for the week from this coming Tuesday, make the most of it. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. Well, on now to our look through the week's news, and I'm joined by our two local councillors. Michael Popham is Clifton East councillor from the leading Lib Dem group, as well as Cabinet Minister for Value for Money. Welcome to BCFM, Michael.
Hello, Tony.
Mike, how long have you actually been a councillor?
A total of 8 years, 2 years in Bristol.
And what about your value for money portfolio? Tell us all about that, because I think there may be council taxpayers out there wondering if they are getting value for money.
Well, we would never say they are. We will always try to do better. That's the thing we must do in council. And there is certainly quite an exciting programme of change going on to increase value for money. We've not been that good over the years, but we're getting better.
So how long have you been doing this for? Because this is one of the things I think people do find frustrating sometimes, is that somebody is like yourself is able to say, well, actually, I'm sorry, but I haven't been in charge for long enough to really change things.
I think we need to remember that we're councillors and remind ourselves we've got some very competent officers around doing all this work continuously. And of course, what we do is take a view on what they're doing, what the public might want from it. And if we see the need for changing what's happening, then we do. And that's very much our role as councillors.
OK, so how long have you actually been doing this task? Because the Liberals have been in the ruling group for quite a while now.
Well, quite a while. In February, the Labour Party resigned at budget full council. The Liberal Democrats were then put in control. We took up the responsibility for that, stepped into our respective roles, organised ourselves. In my case, from February, I was the shadow member for housing before that, but I then became cabinet member for efficiency and value for money. So since February, I've been doing that role.
Now, just before the show, we were talking about Iceland. I understand that Bristol City Council has had some money council taxpayers' money invested in Iceland with these banks that then subsequently collapsed. Can you just explain how that happened and what's happening now about it?
Well, seemingly, as a matter of routine, councils have been investing money in external organisations under what we would expect to be quite precise controls. We were all surprised to find that things were not that sound. We've all been surprised, taken aback by what's happened. The situation for the City Council is that we are said to be quite high up on the priority list for creditors, which means that we should be fairly confident of getting most of that money back.
Fingers crossed, then.
Oh, absolutely, fingers crossed, yes.
OK, now let's go on to Charlie. Charlie Bolton is Bristol's only Green councillor, and he hails from Southville. Welcome, Charlie.
Hi, Mike.
When were you first elected, Charlie?
Ooh, 2006, 3 years ago.
Why do you think Southville was the place where Bristol's first Green councillor came from? Why Southville?
God, that's a question. There's quite a strong green community in Southville. There's certainly a well-organised community, and I think it's also down to the electoral dynamics, shall we put it.
I know there's the Federation of City Farms, for example, down there. And is that what you mean when you say that? Or, there's also the City Farm.
There's a Wynnum Hall City Farm. I'm thinking more of, there's a lot of people I know who live there who are sort of involved in different parts of the green community, some of whom are extremely well known, I think, within the city.
Now, I notice you're still on your own as a green councillor. How did the Greens do more generally in the elections 2 weeks ago?
Well, there's a question. I have to say I was disappointed at the outcome, but the more I think about it, I think it's probably the highest vote we've ever had, certainly in the last 15 years in a city council election. We just haven't quite got to the position of taking other seats yet. I mean, I could point you to Bristol West, where there's a number of seats where we came second, and I think if you looked at the parliamentary constituency of Bristol West as a whole, we finished second as per the council election results. But it's that bit going on from there to winning. No, didn't do that.
Does it frustrate you to find the major parties sort of picking up green ideas and running with them and almost claiming them as their own?
it frustrates me when they claim them as their own, but it doesn't bother me. I mean, I guess I'm extremely pleased that they pick up green ideas. How far they really want to go is open to debate, but then how far you can really go in a local council is also open to debate. I mean, some of the bigger issues to do with, you know, expanding global capitalism, well, Bristol City Council, with the best will in the world, isn't going to abolish capitalism.
OK, now let's take a look at some of this week's stories. Now, you've already had a read through some of these, but today we've just heard that there will be no public inquiry for the Potter's Bar train crash, which killed 7 people and injured 70 people. I must admit, I was scratching my head in disbelief here. This is back in 2002. And instead, there seems that there's going to be an inquest, which is usually only used for an individual death that needs investigating. So, anyway, either of you like to go first on that one?
Yeah, as an ex-maintenance engineer, it troubles me when the public don't get to find out about the precise reasons for a crash, and a major crash at that. So to find the government covering that up, in effect, by not allowing the true evidence to come out, I think is disgraceful.
So you say you've got some sort of background in anything to do with railways or something like that? Or what?
I'm an ex-maintenance engineer. It doesn't matter what type of area that is, but the fundamentals are still there, whatever the system that you're operating with. There was a catastrophic failure here, and we need to know why that happened.
I mean, this is one thing I've been looking into, and it seems that, you know, that whenever there's more than one person that dies in some circumstances which need investigating, the public inquiry is the normal way of doing it, because it's a lot cheaper to hold one rather than several separate inquests, and also it's a lot easier for the victims' families, because they're only having to give one lot of testimony. Anyway, Charlie, what do you think about this train crash, the verdict that there will be no public inquiry into the Potter's Bar train crash?
I think what bothers me is the length of delay, which has been, as you said, 2002, and now it's 2009, and we're still not getting anything happening. I mean, it's absurd, really. I don't know the technicalities and about the differences between a public inquiry or an inquest, but surely what you need is somebody to have the power to go and ask the questions they want to ask, get the answers what they want to get, and then get any recommendations to government or whoever to get them implemented, to make the changes, to get the rail service we want. We want a safe, really top-quality rail service, which is well-used. We don't want one with sort of doubts hanging over its safety, and of course you've already referred to the impact on the families and their inability to get the answers they want.
Well, technically, a public inquiry is simply an inquest where multiple people have died in related circumstances. Okay, well, let's go on to looking at the European elections, which were a couple of weeks ago. Now, how did your various parties get on in the European elections? Maybe, Mike, you'd like to go first.
Yeah, well, we secured our seat, which I'm sure we would have liked more, but we secured that seat. We must be happy with that and look at ways in which we can improve in the future.
Charlie?
Across the country as a whole, we had two seats before. We've got two seats now. Our vote went up by, I think it's about 30% or something. In the southwest, where I think there's 5 million voters, we finished something like 12,000 short of picking up the sixth seat. It's just one of those incredibly frustrating things. Nearly.
Sounds a little bit like the local picture.
A bit.
Anyway, one of the things that mystified me about the Euro elections was the delay in counting. I don't know if either of you have any idea why that was, because I was looking into that, and it takes a few days to actually do the counting for the Euro elections.
Well, the election sheet was long, and so that must have been quite a challenge for offices in the count. I guess that's the only reason, really. So many candidates, and that takes time. They could have compensated, I guess, by increasing the capacity of people there to count them, but I'm not sure if Charlie would.
So are you talking about the length of the time taken to do the count?
Yeah, it was, I mean,
the Thursday and the Sunday.
That's right,
the
delay between Thursday and Sunday.
I understand it's to do because the other countries in Europe, some of them vote on the Sunday, so they want to declare all the results at the same time. I was at the European election count in Bristol, and my God, it went on for hours, and you have to feel sorry for the poor people doing it. They had this is not going to be good radio, but they had a piece of paper, what's that, 2 foot long?
Yep, two or three, actually,
and
I think.
They were getting, unfolding them one by one, and there was over 100,000 bits.
Oh, no.
I mean, it was a horrendous process, and I've got to think of their arm ache by the end of it.
So, anyway, let's move on to look at another news story this week, which is mortgage lending figures. I mean, we had this massive bailout a few months ago of all the banks, but it does seem that that this money is not being lent out, and that for some reason it's not finding its way into loans. Mortgage lending figures for May, which came out yesterday, are down to an all-time low. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, why is it that this money that the government has handed over to the banks to reignite the lending and get the economy going again isn't trickling down? Any thoughts, Mike?
Well, I guess the banks are currently making sure they rebuild their balance sheets. I'm sure that'll be a first priority. It's just very, very disappointing with all this government intervention. Now ownership of the banks that people themselves are not being served better. We should put pressure on, and we should go in a little bit deeper and find out why these are not happening, and stand up as a government and take control of these things.
You say rebuilding the balance sheets. I mean, we're seeing a lot more openness from MPs after this expenses scandal. Do you think we should be able to see inside the accounts of the banks as well? Because they've been actually very secretive about exactly where their investments are.
Well, the banks we own, yes, we should. I don't think it's right to put huge amounts of public money into a bank to take ownership of it and not take some semblance of control over what they're doing, when they do it, and why they do it.
I mean, the banks have come really to the Chancellor, cap in hand, saying, look, we want this money so we can get the economy going again, we can start lending. And it does seem that there's a lack of actual sort of closing on the deal. At the end of the day, the banks aren't delivering.
Seemingly not, no. Perhaps it's they're waiting for house prices to stabilise, who knows. But I guess there's a social dimension to this now that we own the amount that we do. People need to be looked after, people need homes, and that should be the first priority of any modern responsible society.
And would you advocate actually sacking some of the directors of these banks if this money doesn't come down to ordinary people?
If our government can't make things move in that respect, then there's something seriously wrong. We need some stronger talking, we need some stronger direction, and we need these people who are now salaried by the public to do things better.
Anyway, Charlie, what's your thoughts on this one?
It makes me wonder if the money's gone to be lent out, or if the money's just gone to pay off the debts. I mean, I used to work for a bank. I used to work for Abbey National, and latterly I worked for a subsidiary of HBOS. And you may remember the director of HBOS was then implicated in something. I remember seeing him on HBOS TV on a Wednesday morning, being really gung-ho about HBOS's expansion plans and how it's going to go out and be... Oh, it's the same story from independent or private company after private. They want to grow, they want to be the biggest, the number one in the sector, blah, 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 blah. And it to me, it all goes back... It goes back to Thatcher. A lot of things go back to Thatcher. It goes sometime in the 80s, they deregulated lending in the banking sector. And there was before that, there was a strict limit. And this was at the time when places like the Abbey National and HBOS were building societies and they could demutualise after it. But there are strict limits on the amount of unsecured lending they can do. And sometime after that, following that deregulation and the failure of the Labour Party to do anything to rein it back in, they've just gone ahead and lent more and more and more and more and more on stuff where obviously the money simply isn't there. They've just taken huge gambles.
So
a lot of them.
So do you think, okay, so do you think that the Chancellor should be getting a bit tougher then, and the government as a whole should be getting a bit tougher with the banks?
Well, in some ways, I think the fact that... the Labour Party have managed to nationalise the banks and achieve one of the great aims of socialism, possibly one of the most unlikely Labour governments ever to do it, is a good thing. But yes, now they're there. If what we want is to have more lending, yes, we do. But I mean, the lending we were doing was at unsustainable levels anyway. It was. God, it used to be like three times the joint wage of people's salaries, what you'd expect to be able to pay back. Then it seemed to go up to five. And I've no idea what it ended up as, but I mean, if you're lending at levels way beyond what people can pay, what people can pay back, and especially with the uncertainties and the changes in the system, which might come along afterwards, then you're heading for extremely risky situations for large numbers of individual people.
Yes, but hang on a minute, though. If someone's waving lots of money saying, would you like to borrow this? It's very tempting to grab it, isn't it? Even if you think you may not be able to pay it back.
Well, yeah, and that's obviously what happened. And I did this in 1990. Before I moved to Bristol, I bought, it was the last boom, I bought a house in Milton Keynes, dare I say it, and they had a property crash. I ended up with several thousand pounds of negative equity. Well, I'm one of those sort of lucky middle class people that managed to get his way out of it, but there's loads of other people who aren't lucky and haven't managed to get their way out of it, and there's loads of people now who've been in the same situation. So they're faced with the situation of being unable to move for several years if they choose to do so, which may or may not be a good thing, or unable to get a loan, and it's I don't know, the whole system of having the price of houses shooting up because of market forces, because of the whole fact that demand is so much less than supply.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's led to the huge rise in house prices in the first place. Therefore, you need the greater levels of lending. Therefore, you get the banks lending higher and higher amounts of money.
Yeah, just play back a bit. Charlie set off with Margaret Thatcher. I do know that way back then there was a fundamental change with an emphasis more towards deregulation. And I think that, regulation per se is fine, but it's the degree of regulation.
But as a liberal, surely, you know, you want to let these markets just kind of get on, do their own thing, surely. You don't want to be regulating too much.
Not too much, of course not. What I'm very interested in is actually why Gordon Brown rationalised the regulatory authorities into one, into the FSA. And I wouldn't mind betting if we had time to research that and find out exactly why it was done and how it stacked up with any degree of reason. That was a critical milestone for concern as far as I'm concerned.
Well, let's move on from that then. And one of the spin-offs from this MP's expenses scandal that's happened over the last month or so is the calls for electoral reform, and that's changing the voting system from a first-past-the-post system to proportional representation. I wonder if either of you have got thoughts about that, whether that actually would be good for democracy.
Great idea. What do you reckon, Mark?
Absolutely. It's a fundamental
we were agreed on that then.
Fundamental policy of Liberal Democrats.
But why? Why is PR better?
From a point of view from my point of view, it's the current. Well, take the local election results. 14% people voted Green. We got no councillors. 17% voted Labour. They got 16 councillors and held two seats. The system is in no way representative of the views of the people of the city. Now, you can argue in the case of councillors, they're probably the one level of democracy at which you can actually have the real local input. But in principle, surely, we have a system which fails to represent the views of large numbers of people.
We need a level playing field. It's a distorted system as we have today. People are becoming increasingly disengaged with politics rather than the other way around. And I'm sure if they felt that their vote would count proportionately, they would be far more interested in the whole process. We should have proportional representation.
Do you think that it would mean that more people would be voting for the small fringe parties like Respect and maybe even the BNP? Is that not a concern?
Well, certainly not the BNP, but people must vote as they want to vote, and it's for the parties themselves to put their message across. And any respectable party worth their salt will put their message across and convince people they are right. That's the game we have in a democracy.
Charlie, what do you think?
I'm starting to reach the stage where I think that with the BNP, you've got to start to take them on. You can't just sort of ignore them or you've got to argue against them. I mean, it is a concern, and I understand. I don't have a problem with Respect getting votes. I'd applaud it. But
when they're taken on, we beat them.
Yeah, it's a bit of a thorny subject, but I mean, immigration is a thorny issue, and this is one of the things that the BNP really do get votes on the immigration issue. Do you think that there's really any difference between the idea of people coming to Britain as refugees or as economic migrants, either of you?
Refugees are one thing, but immigration per se is quite different. The Liberal Democrats are fully supportive of sustainable communities, and what that basically means that any change that is likely to impact on our ability to look after people, we must consider it seriously.
Charlie?
I think, to me, at one level, part of the answer is to... I mean, I have to, it almost goes back to a climate change thing. It's a contraction and convergence sort of thing. It's contraction and convergence is the idea of people with worse standards of living, well, you improve them, and those of us living in the wealthier societies, well, we have to contract, and therefore you meet somewhere in the middle. And it's the same. I mean, the reason we have economic migrants is because there's an economic case for them to come here. They'll earn more money here. So if you can improve the standards of living there so that they don't want to, then that's all power to them, and that's one way to go. I don't have a problem with people coming here to look for work. Once they're here, I would like to see them sort of act and behave in sustainable ways, but no problems to me.
Do you think, but I'll ask you both of you this one separately, but do you agree with opening our job market to Eastern Europe, Mike? You think it's okay to just have anybody from Eastern Europe coming in and getting jobs here?
I think the important thing is to have harmonised policies across Europe so that we're all operating to the same rules, and the economic ebbs and flows of the of our continent are fulfilled as they need to be fulfilled. There needs to be flexibility of labour across Europe, but I would not want to see any sort of restrictions biased towards one country against another.
But you see, the argument of a lot of people is that this ends up by being a kind of dumbing down. It means that people in Britain are then getting less and less wages because of these economic migrants. I mean, this is, you know, at the heart of one of the reasons why the BNP is getting more votes.
Well, British workers go overseas too, and we do so and we welcome it. There needs to be a level playing field. That's the way to sort this out.
Well, the Green Party policy on Europe is to have a more of a Europe of the region. I mean, if you have a single jobs market and you have a single market, it all feeds into the sort of the globalisation process and the idea of goods being transported further and further and all the rest of it. And that's what goes counter to the idea of having a sustainable society, which we're supposed to be fighting for.
Okay, another big item in the news this week has been the announcement, finally, of an inquiry into the Iraq war. Now, to begin with, the Prime Minister was saying that it was going to be a secret inquiry. Actually, no, I think he used the word private, not secret. And since then, we've heard that actually there's been a bit of pressure being put on by some senior generals and retired generals in the army, and that now there will be a certain amount of this heard in public. Why do you think it's taken such a long time, which is it's now 6 years, for there to actually be an inquiry into this?
Because they don't want anybody to know the results.
Exactly that. It's just a huge embarrassment to this country. We've got the official opposition party, the Conservatives, in Parliament saying they believed everything that was said to them across the floor of the House. Excuse me, grow up. No way. Get it open, find out what the reasons were, and let's go into this in depth and let the public know. There is international interest in this, and people should know.
Well, the whole thing's absurd, isn't it? I mean, they should have done this years ago. I mean, I don't know, is it Blair who started to hide it? I don't know.
Yeah, well, it will be certainly interesting to see what comes out. I think it's also, I found it quite interesting to see that the forces themselves were leading the call to get this in public. I find that quite amazing.
And also the intelligence community. I mean, how compelling is that? The intelligence community, defence chiefs, all wanting an open inquiry.
But wasn't it?
Defence chiefs at the time of the war having to get a letter from the Prime Minister to say that this was legal? I mean, how unusual is that?
But it's interesting to have the defence chiefs, because surely it was the intelligence which was faulty at that point. So maybe that they may be risking their own jobs.
Intelligence is intelligence, and you don't go to war on intelligence alone.
Maybe they have a case for wanting it all out in the open. Who knows?
Well, let's hope that one sort of develops in the next few weeks, and that we hear a little bit more about that story as well. Finally, looking at these national stories. We've also heard this week that the trial by jury is under threat. There's a complex Heathrow robbery trial which has been again and again heard and had to be cancelled or suspended and restarted. Will be heard without a jury by a judge deciding everything on his own, and there are hints of jury tampering being at the heart of this. I mean, this is the first time, I believe, in Britain since around about the time, maybe for several hundred years, that we've had a big criminal trial like this without a jury. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that this is about time, or is it a dangerous precedent?
This is clearly a very, very exceptional case. and I think we need to put our trust in the appeal court judges over this matter. There's clearly a lot of inhibits going on to justice in this case. There's been a huge amount of money spent, £24 million. I mean, goodness me, what could we have done with that money? I think in this case, we've got to put our trust in them. This is probably the right thing, but it should not be, of course, the rule.
Charlie?
I do remember, and I may be an apocryphal story of something about complex legal cases, the defence wait until the eyes of the last jurors glazed over, so they completely lost track of what's going on. So I suppose that might be at the root of what they're trying to do. But in principle, you don't want judges just having the power. You want them to have the trial by jury. Surely that's what it's all about.
Okay, so and also finally we've got the summer solstice coming up on Saturday evening. Will you both be going down to Stonehenge?
I should probably be working on casework for my people in Clifton East.
I'm going to the Axminster Flower Show.
Okay, but you're not going to Stonehenge then.
I did once go to was it Stanton Drew when they had the eclipse.
Oh yeah.
So there's enough of the hippie within.
Okay. And what do you think? Do you know much about the Stonehenge thing? Because it's now a kind of event which is run by English Heritage, isn't it? It's quite changed from the old hippie festival of the 70s.
I've been walking around Stonehenge and seen. I mean, it's not just the main the stone circle that everybody knows. There's a whole complex of things which go on there. There's a woodhenge a bit down the road. There's an avenue nearby, and there's a whole sort of ritual thing going on there about how people used to live, and a whole set of theories which have been developed. I don't think the festivals which are going on there now, or even the ones back in the 80s or whatever, had much to do with what was going on traditionally.
Okay, now we're going to go over to a story now about something which was due to happen in the High Court on Tuesday. Now, I just want to check that he's joining us okay on the line. Jim Bates, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I'll have to turn you up a little bit, Jim. You're quite quiet there. The story is about Colin Port, the Avon and Somerset Chief Constable, who has, at the 11th hour, handed back some computers belonging to the expert computer witness, Jim Bates. Colin Port is no stranger to controversy. In the South West One scandal, about a year or so ago, Colin chose his own wife to manage the privatisation of police civilian support services and large parts of North Somerset Council, handing them over to IBM. Anyway, Jim, I wonder if you could just acquaint us a little bit with your angle on this case and tell us about, you know, who you are and why you were involved.
Well, as most of the newspapers have reported, I've been for well over 20 years a computer forensic specialist, working since 1986 when the first computer viruses appeared, and I've initially helping mainly the police and government in cases ranging through international fraud, theft, industrial sabotage, rape, even murder, as well as sensitive cases for governments, both here and overseas. Most of these, as I say, were for the prosecution. But I built a reputation for producing accurate and reliable analyses, and you must understand that the majority of the work is simply factual. Examine a computer, analyse what you find to find out what's happened on the computer, whether it's the result of user activity, what the dates and times were, all of that sort of stuff.
Okay, so can you just take us through what happened with this case? Because I understand that you were just about to be an expert witness in another case involving the Irish police.
The
Irish police.
Irish police. No.
Sorry. Okay. Well, can you just talk about the run-up to when you were actually when the computers were seized?
Involved in a couple of other cases at the moment, but this particular one was a gentleman who lives, he actually lives in Bristol, or certainly in the suburbs of Bristol, And I had been engaged by him, it's by the defendant himself, to produce a report into his computer, which had been seized by the police. I had gone with a colleague. Initially, my colleague was the expert witness instructed by counsel, and I simply went on to assist, because there were certain questions concerning what's known as malicious code. In other words, nasty programs which you can pick up on your computer, which can allow all sorts of things to happen without the user being aware of it. It's an area that I have specialised in. So we went after an appointment to the Bristol High Tech Crime Unit to take an image copy, which is the first stage of forensic examination, of the defendant's hard drive. We also had some tests to do to confirm the validity of the hardware, the computer itself. So we did that. We were given the computer to look at. We took the hard. There were two hard drives. We took them out. We imaged the main hard drive onto an identical hard drive, same model, same version, everything, which we then put into the machine to start the machine up to do the various tests. And again, this is fairly standard stuff. So we completed those tests, but the process of running this drive would naturally have altered things on it, so we took another clone, which would not have altered anything, so we then had something to look at from a pure forensic point of view to see what sequences of events we could recover from it. Once we'd finished with it, we signed the exhibit labels, as we've done hundreds of times. Thank you very much to the police, and away we went carrying the clones. Far as that was in, I believe, June of last year. Excuse me. We did our work, and it was during this work that I identified this malicious code. And at that point, it was decided that I would have to go into the witness box to explain this, because it is my specialty. Two days before the trial, my colleague and I were both raided by the police. In spite of the fact that the police were told that the majority of the stuff in my house, in fact all of the computer stuff, is legally privileged, it's protected by law, they said they could seize anything they liked, whipped me away to Rugby Police Station, it was about 20 miles away from where I live, and proceeded to grab all of the computer equipment that they found, which was seven computers, around 80, 90 hard drives, unknown numbers of CDs, DVDs, memory sticks, and heaven knows what else, and a whole pile of documents from my archive files. And away they went with them. I was interviewed at Rugby Police Station. I eventually left there about half past one the following morning. The charge was that my colleague and I had conspired to possess indecent images of children.
But anyway, what's happened now, Jim, is thankfully you've got your computers back. And so are you happy now?
I'm not happy, no. I'm extremely unhappy. Mainly because of the furore that has been raised by Mr. Port's statements in the press, which I find absolutely extraordinary.
So would you like to say why you find them extraordinary?
Well, the main press article was in The Sun, where Mr. Port made a number of statements which were, to say the least, inaccurate. He was extremely economical with the truth. He spoke of 2,500 printed images. We weren't allowed to actually look at these until last Friday. When we did look, there weren't 2,500, there were about 250. Mr. Paul says he didn't know where they came from. They were, in fact, inside case files in my archives. They were almost all prosecution exhibits. The case files they were in were complete with references and even telephone numbers of the officers involved in those cases. So there's no way he could not have known where they came from. It was suggested that it was highly likely. Bear in mind, this is all printed documentation. In this article, it was suggested it was highly likely that the hard drives contained indecent material going back to the 1990s. It's just simply not true. Those cases that I had retained with the associated images dated from 2002 and were all cases where there were questions about the reliability of the forensic evidence presented. They'd been retained for my protection against continuing allegations and intimidation from the police that I was being dishonest in the content of my reports.
Anyway, Jim, thanks very much for joining us, and I think it's quite interesting to hear, after we've heard quite a lot around the city about this case, something from your point of view. With our two councillors in the studio here, can I just have some quick comments from you two about what you think about this case? Because it's quite extraordinary to have a chief constable facing jail and a High Court order.
Seems to me, I suppose, that if the police are confident of their case, they wouldn't have given the stuff back. So the fact they've given it back suggests to me there's something, maybe it's just a cock-up or something, I don't know, but whatever it is, they should perhaps be explaining what's going on.
I don't think it's appropriate to comment at all, really. Let due process happen and see what comes out.
Yeah, because the reason we had Jim on today is because there's been quite a lot of comment in the local papers from Colin, from the local chief constable, and very little from Jim, and mainly because he's actually over in Leicestershire and quite difficult to get hold of.
What we've tried
to do is have a little bit of both sides now. Anyway, let's move on to talk about our next story, and we're going to start off with a recording by Neil Roberts here. This is from yesterday, actually, and it's to do with the Iranian elections. Yesterday, up to 100 Bristol Iranians and their supporters gathered for 3 hours on College Green in Bristol to demonstrate in solidarity with pro-democracy protests in Iran. Organisers said they were not supporting any particular party, in fact they were adamant about that, but wanted to show their support for the Iranian people. The protest was organised amongst 500 to 600 Iranians living in Bristol via social media sites like Facebook. Protesters held banners calling for democracy in Iran and attacking President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Many of the protesters did not want to be identified but spoke about their concerns over human rights abuses and the lack of freedom under the Iranian regime.
We are gathering here, this is the voice of Iran. We are all Iranian and we want to tell the government the word is wrong and it's been like fraud in it. We want the real word from Iranian people. That's the thing we are gathering here. And we don't want dictator in our country. Our people don't want like atomic bomb or anything. We want freedom. We want to be the human. We are in human right. That's it.
I'm Yunus. I'm studying IT here in Bristol. We came here to express our deep concerns, not only about political issues, but also about the humanities and human rights. Like suppressing peaceful protesters is not only a political issue. It's not only about like who won the election or who has lost the election. That is something separate. Although we strongly believe that a huge fraud has happened in election, but that is not the only issue. Even the more important thing is that humanity is in threat. Ahmadinejad is a real threat, is a serious threat, with his dangerous nuclear plans and with his with ignoring all humanities or human rights and killing people and suppressing people. That is a thing. That is a major thing that we've got here to express our concerns.
Yeah, we're just here protesting mainly to try and get a fair election in Iran because it's obviously really important. That's what everyone wants. Also to try and separate religion from government out there because there's been a really unfair election. No, it's good that everyone's protesting. We are a little bit worried that it might end up as an extreme situation, but I think really what the people want is just a fair election, so we're here to try and help that.
Yes, I just want to say that what's happened in Iran is very unfair, and everybody knows that this guy, no one has voted for him, but I'm talking about Ahmadinejad. He's claiming that people have voted for him, but it's absolutely wrong. No one is really. I can say from every 100 person, maybe just one person like him, and it's very sad that they have been shooting to people now, but still is people are trying to get their rights.
I'm Iranian, and we came here because we are not happy about the election result. They changed the election result, and they put Ahmadinejad again as a prime minister, and we are not happy about it because it's not true. The Iranian people select someone else. That's why it's not fair.
And have you had any contact with friends or family back there at the moment that are seeing the big protest going on, the violence on the street?
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. They treated people so badly. They injured young people, and the mobile access in Iran is now completely blocked. And it's a very, very difficult situation in Iran at the moment, yeah.
What would you like to see happen ideally in Iran?
I would like to people in my country be happy and have a real freedom, you know. Everyone, every human being have a right to have a freedom, and we all wish that.
We're obviously not happy about the election result, and we know there's foul play going on here. So we just want as many voices as possible from everywhere to show that we want freedom, that's it.
Well, that was recorded yesterday, and it was about 100 or so Bristol Iranians and their supporters gathering for 3 hours on College Green, demonstrating their solidarity with the pro-democracy protests in Iran. Now, Mike and Charlie, would you like to just give us your view about the protests in Tehran and other cities in Iran, and what you think about this election?
Well, it's a very disappointing situation to exist after what seemed to be a fairly organised election. The last thing I think we should be doing is making comment which could add to the instability that exists. People have died out there. I think the international community should address the situation, probably through the UN, at the right time, if indeed it needs that. But at the moment, we should do all we can to keep it stable and prevent any further loss of life.
I'm not sure. I seem to remember hearing something about the American government and Barack Obama wanting to actively keep out of it because America's got such a bad reputation over in that area, and I suspect Britain equally doesn't have a very good reputation in the area. So in terms of our countries or our governments getting involved, I think keep out. But beyond that, I'd certainly agree and endorse what Mike's been saying.
So do you think that these protests are genuine, or is there any element of them being encouraged by the Western interest? Because, you know, obviously we're hearing all the time about Iran being a sort of dastardly regime and a dangerous regime. Is this part of that, or is it separate?
I'm always a bit wary.
Difficult to know, maybe.
Well, it's what you see on the telly, isn't it? It's watching Newsnight and seeing, is it John Simpson and the late at night and the people going out on their roofs and shouting. Well, I guess you have to believe it, and there seem to be sufficient things that I've seen suggest there's at least some element of truth in it, which suggests to me there's something not quite right there.
Yeah, I was actually quite impressed with the nature of the demonstrations that were going on. Demonstrations should be allowed. People should be free to demonstrate. The notable thing in this case was that they were hugely determined to be demonstrating peacefully, and that in itself I think was quite compelling about the pro-democracy people out there.
It's difficult though, isn't it? Because all you need is a very tiny element of people who aren't interested in peaceful demonstration for things to turn nasty. Anyway, let's move on from that. Luckily, the demonstration here in Bristol was entirely peaceful. Anyway, so let's have a look at some other local stories here. There was one here. Just a second. Where is it? Oh, yes. The Bristol University have announced that some of their students have swine flu this week. Some more students. What do you think about this? Is this something we really need to be concerned about? Is it something we should take deadly seriously, or is it just a kind of little bit of a cold people are getting?
Well, I'm just pleased to say that the UK has prepared itself very, very well indeed, and who can blame us for that? We've done exactly the right thing in preparing for what we still don't know how the spread of this will turn out. What I am pleased about is that I think we're very lucky that the students who were unfortunate enough to catch this were few in number, but it happened just before the summer holidays. So I guess that will help to contain the spread of it. Very worrying, but we are well prepared, and I guess people should take the advice.
Charlie, are you biting your nails about catching swine flu?
Well, I mean, when it started, was it? It was Mexico. There were a large number of deaths, and I don't know if anybody. I haven't heard whether they were, it's been confirmed whether they were to do with swine flu or unrelated, or there were some other factors at work. But the spread, as it's gone on since then, I haven't seen much to suggest it's that bad. I can see that it could be that bad for, I suppose, elderly people or infirm people or people who are more likely to suffer from various illness. This is in that way. So for their sake, yes, we should take the precautions. But it's a struggle to see how it's. I mean, it hadn't been that bad so far. I guess that's the point.
And you get both going to be taking your Tamiflu tablets.
No.
We were discussing this.
Fingers crossed, no.
We were discussing this a couple of weeks ago, and one of our guests pointed out that it was actually Donald Rumsfeld, the ex-US Defence Secretary, is one of the major shareholders in the company that produces Tamiflu. But maybe he's just got his finger in a lot of pies. Also, I'd like to just ask you a couple of sort of generic questions we ask everyone when they came in here. Everyone's floating this idea about an elected mayor, and I'd just like to take both of your views about whether it would actually be a benefit to Bristol to have an elected mayor.
I think the cabinet would need to discuss this, the group would need to discuss this, and we would take a position appropriately.
But about your own view, though?
Well, I'm interested in anything that will help the people of Bristol. I have to... my mind goes along the route that huge impact can one person have? It's the system of governance overall and how well that is refreshed by people's good ideas about what they need and our ability to turn that round that matters, not the status of one person in council.
Charlie?
There's a number of different things tied with the state of local democracy in Britain. I mean, there's a bit of that PR we were talking about earlier, which we both said we'd support. There's been a campaign for four yearly all-up elections for the council, which is, I think it was former councillor Terry Cook initiated, which I have some sympathy with, or I haven't finally decided either way, because you can see that would give the stability that having yearly elections would currently deprive you of. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess from a selfish, let's promote the Green Party point of view, an elected mayor, as they have in London, with some sort of scrutiny function of what do they call them, the London Assembly, I can see a value in that. But that's from the point of view of the Green Party. I think a mayor's got to be really good to have all the right policies for all the areas that need sorting out in Bristol. And I'm not sure that one person's easily going to do it.
Can I not pin you down, Mike, one way or the other, yes or no?
I have to be very strongly convinced that a change in that direction would be beneficial to the people of Bristol.
I mean, you're on the cabinet yourself, aren't you? Mm-hmm. So can you just give us an idea of how it works for those people who maybe are used to the older system where we didn't have a cabinet in Bristol City Council?
OK, well, you've got eight people elected to cabinet positions by the Liberal Democrat group. That happens every year. We decide among ourselves... the split of responsibilities, but it certainly operates on the basis of collective responsibility. So, for example, someone from a public meeting, as I had last night, would like to see change in some particular way. I've got to say to myself, well, that's just one person. What about the rest? What do they think? My first instinct is to debate on that more widely with the public and then to bring that to my group and table it as a proposition for change. We then would take that forward in whatever way it needs to be taken forward, and ultimately it would be put before the floor of the House by the Cabinet.
But presumably another problem with having an elected mayor is it comes a whole thing about personalities. It's the personality of the mayor, and if you had a mayor, they would have to have people dealing... I mean, Boris Johnson has various advisers or deputy mayors or whatever, which sounds like it's almost a Cabinet system anyway.
What about you, though, Charlie? Because you're sort of on your own as the only Green. Do you find it a bit difficult to get engaged with stuff? Do you feel you're on the fringes of the city council?
I'm certainly on the edge.
Well, if I can chip in, I mean the Liberal Democrats have many many years of environmental development within our policies, but of course broader policies as well. We very much see Charlie as a friend.
But what are you actually doing, Charlie, as a councillor? I mean, are you on some of these main committees, like the planning committee and this kind of thing?
There's a whole thing about you have to be a group to sit on the statutory committees, and I'm not a group. A group is two councillors more, so I don't get to do those. I have, in the past, the other groups have allowed me to sit on the scrutiny commissions. In the first year I was a councillor, it was when the Lib Dems were in power, actually, I did sit on a committee, the Public Rights of Way, but not since then. It would certainly help our cause to do our politics to have more councillors.
Okay, well, Charlie Bolton, Southville Green councillor, and just remind me, is it Clifton East? Mike
Clifton
Popham,
East, yes, indeed.
Liberal Democrat, thanks ever so much.
And the prospective Member of Parliament for Bristol East.
Are you? Right, okay. Yes, so we might be seeing you elevated to Westminster in the election.
That's the intention.
Possibly. Yes. Okay, well, thanks both very much for joining us here today. And coming up in a minute is Marina Morris with her report on ageing.
BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Now, you may remember 2 weeks ago or so, Marina Morris was in the studio with us here, and she was doing a report on ageing. Now, Marina, would you like to carry on and do that now?
Yes, people are living longer, but this is causing problems. Europe is aging. The current lifespan of an average European is about 83. This is average health span, the time people are free from chronic illness, of only 67. And it's really big problem.
What about the demographic situation over in Russia? Because you're from Eastern Europe, aren't you?
Oh, yes. Average life expectancy for Russian women is about 72. For Russian men, it's less than 60. About 15 years lower than in most other industrialized countries. Russia has set aside almost $3 billion US dollars for an emergency program to tackle its epidemic of ill health and falling life expectancy. Experts point out that much of Russia's health crisis is a result of unhealthy lifestyle, especially very high rate of smoking and alcohol abuse.
But hang on a second, Marina. What about the latest information regarding longevity in Britain here?
Here, there are some things that you must consider before you retire. The Cambridge University Group for the History of Population and Social Structure advised that at the moment, the government predicts British male life expectancy will rise from 75 to 78 and female from 80 to 83 by 2025. Yet both these levels have already been reached by Japan. A typical female baby born this year in the world's wealthier countries, such as France, already has 50-50 chance of living to be 100 years.
So do you know who's the oldest person on the planet? Because I think that's been in the news today.
There are a number of potential claimants. Probably one of the oldest is Esther Apiuda from Uganda, who is believed to have been born in 1893, making her about 116 years old.
Thanks very much, Marina. So what are you intending to talk about next week?
In the next program, we'll talk about a lifestyle as a key driver of extending longevity.
Thanks very much. Well, it's coming up to 6 o'clock, and so that's all we have time for this week. Join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time every week here on BCFM, where we'll be picking apart some of the less well-reported news in Bristol, Britain and around the world. Except next week, when we'll be drive-timing an hour later from 6 until 7. We've been nudged slightly by the Glastonbury Festival coverage, but after that we'll be back to 5 o'clock as usual. If you have news you want discussed, questions about tonight's programme, or would like to suggest a topic for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks to our reporter Neil Roberts. And our guests were Lib Dem Councillor for Clifton East, Mike Popham, and Green Party Councillor for Southfield, Charlie Bolton. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We have about 60 million people in Britain and 60 million acres of land, so while it might seem sometimes that there's not enough resources to go round, that's only because corporations and the super rich have taken quite literally piles and piles more than their fair share. All we have to do is make sure that 60 million acres is shared out. With modern technology, not controlled by a rich elite, we can all live quite happily together. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
are listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.